Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
The roads, rails, and trails of Virginia hold many stories. We're going to visit places of lore from Tidewater to Southwest today on Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Our featured guest is Joe Tennis. He's written many books about where and how to visit the treasures of Virginia. His most recent work is the new book, Washington County, Virginia, Then and Now. Three other guests will be joining us later on, Richmond authors Emily and John Salmon, and Bill Arnold with the O. Winston Link Museum in Roanoke. But first, Joe Tennis. Joe is a Virginia Beach native who has spent most of his life along historic Route 58 in Virginia. It's the state's longest numbered route, running over 500 miles from Virginia Beach to Lee County before heading out to Tennessee. Joe wrote about Route 58 in Beach to Bluegrass, Places to Break on Virginia's Longest Road. It came out in 2007 and inspired Virginia tourism leaders to create the Beaches to Bluegrass Trail, linking Virginia Beach with the Crooked Road region of Southwest Virginia. Joe's first book in 2004 was Southwest Virginia Crossroads, and it remains a definitive guide to the 17 counties southwest of Roanoke. Joe, welcome.
Thank you, May Lily.
First of all, you live in Bristol, Virginia now. Do you ever miss living near the beach?
Well, sure, and I go out to visit. My folks are there. My dad, actually, Richard Tennis, came up with the title Beach to Bluegrass, and it was just a crazy idea when I said, I want to write a book about Route 58, and he says, well, you're going, you're going over to the Cumberland Gap Historical Park, which is the doorway to Kentucky. So I was going from the beach to the bluegrass state of Kentucky. He said, call it Beach to Bluegrass. And I believe having this book, Beach to Bluegrass, I carry a little bit of Virginia Beach and the coast with me all the time because I'm off, a couple days a week, at book fairs or talks or things like that. And people are always asking me, well, where did you grow up? And I said, well, it starts in this book. So it's kind of a cool thing.
Joe, you were in West Virginia just this morning. You're on the road so much, but tell me about the town you just visited.
I was in Thurman, West Virginia's population of 6, and working on an article for Blue Ridge Country Magazine, and I was named a contributing editor of the magazine. Been working for them for 15 years, and some of Beach to Bluegrass actually came from that work in doing my newspaper work down at the newspaper in Bristol, at the Bristol Herald Courier, which incidentally is a Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper, won the Pulitzer Prize for public service in 2010. And along the way, I do a few stories a year for Blue Ridge Country. And all of the books have always spurred from that.
We're going to start out with giving our listeners an image of Virginia Beach. And then we're going to head westward. So we're going to ask that people close their eyes, unless you're driving, and imagine yourself on the east end of our state. And then Joe's going to take us on a little tour.
Should I provide ocean waves?
There you go. We're now in Virginia Beach.
And I think all great books of Virginia, and I think John and Emily would also agree in some of the works that they have done, is you have to start off with the Jamestown settlers. And that's really where Virginia begins on April 26, 1607. And that's where Beach to Bluegrass begins, because I begin with that journey and that fight for the Europeans to get across the ocean and land at the beach. And, of course, they had the, failed attempts at Roanoke Island and eventually landing at Cape Henry and then going on to Jamestown. And where Beach to Bluegrass picks up in Chapter 2 is the monopoly on the ocean front. We have all of our streets in Virginia Beach, Atlantic, Pacific, Baltic, Mediterranean. It looks like a monopoly board because it was named after streets in Atlantic City. And at one time, we had a wonderful hotel that burned in 1907. It was the Princess Anne Hotel. It was fabulous. And people like President Grover Cleveland and Alexander Graham Bell stayed there. They had a ballroom and a post office and enough space for 400 people. But after this fire came out, they needed to come up with a new hotel for the Virginia Beach oceanfront. And the Cavalier Hotel was built, and it's still standing. It was built back in the 1920s with 500,000 bricks.
Right. A lot of people think of the Cavalier as being the quintessential old resort, but it was preceded by the Princess Anne, which went up in flames.
Yes. And the Cavalier has, you know, in its day, it was famous for having a dress shop and a drugstore and a stockbroker's office. In the bedrooms, you could lap up luxury with taps running all kinds of water. You had hot water, cold water, ice cold water, and salt water that was running out of your pipes. So it was, you had everybody there that stayed there, from F. Scott Fitzgerald to Judy Garland, the actress, of course, and Hank Ketchum, who came and actually featured the Cavalier in his Dennis the Menace cartoon sketches. You also had several presidents who came in, Richard Nixon, who stayed at the Hunt Room and would have fireside chats with the guests there.
Another story I love in the Virginia Beach area is the story of the Witch of Pungo. Her real name was Grace Sherwood, and she was not immune to that entire witch frenzy that beset Salem. Not Salem, Virginia, but Salem, Massachusetts.
Exactly. And if you travel down Route 58, where it starts at 17th Street and 31st Street and leaving the ocean front, so leaving the Cavalier Hotel, you're passing by these great landmarks, and you will pass over Witch Duck Road, which pays tribute to Grace. Grace was, some say she was beautiful, some say she was ugly, but they said that she could do all kinds of strange things. She could bewitch her. The weather, she could cause your cows to give sour milk, she could blight your cotton crops. They should even say that she could make herself so small that she could fit inside of an eggshell, and then she would use that eggshell to scramble across the Atlantic Ocean like a little boat in the middle of the night, and she would bring back a batch of rosemary from England and then get back in her little boat, her eggshell, and come back, and she'd plant this around the fields of Pungo.
Was rosemary considered a prime herb?
Oh, sure, sure. And so she was eventually put on a trial by water in 1706 and thrown into the waters of the Lynn Haven River. If she sank, she'd be innocent, but of course she'd be dead. And if she didn't sink, well, then she was clearly a witch. They tied her up, threw her in the water. She untied herself. They threw her in the jail. 1740, she died. And in 2006, then Governor Tim Kaine, declared her no longer a witch, even though that's 300 years. So he formally exonerated her 300 years later, but you can still drive down Witch Duck Road.
In politics, that's hard to come by.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I think this is a great time to introduce our first two guests. They are John and Emily Salmon, co-authors of numerous books relating to Virginia. Just amazing the volume of material that these two have put out. They're on the phone now from their home in Richmond. Among the books they've written are Historic Virginia, Your Travel Guide to Virginia's Fascinating Historic Sites, The Hornbook of Virginia History, Remembering Virginia. John is particularly facile in matters relating to the Civil War. Welcome, Emily and John Salmon.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Great to have you. Great to have both of you with us.
Thank you.
You know, while we're here in Virginia Beach, Emily, why don't you talk a little bit about the old Coast Guard station?
Well, it's located at 24th and Boardwalk, and this particular building was constructed in 1903 to replace an older station that stood a block inland, and the purpose of it was for the lifesavers to go out to the boats that were foundering out on the water and bring in the survivors. And what they would do would be to open the wide doors and force the big boats through the surf into the deeper water to get the people. And the station became part of the United States Coast Guard in 1915. And in 1933, there was a big hurricane, and it was enlarged and rehabilitated after that. And during World War II, there was the Battle of the Atlantic that raged up and down the Atlantic coast and all across the Atlantic Ocean. And the German submarines lurking off the east coast attacked Allied shipping, and when the U-boats sank or damaged many vessels within a few miles of the ocean front, the stations such as this one played a big role in rescuing the sailors. And the station was decommissioned in 1969, and then they moved the building about 200 feet to a smaller lot and turned the building so that the life-saving doors face south now. And it contains many, many fascinating exhibits about the surf men, as they were called, and about World War II and the life saving that took place during then. And they have special events during the year, including ghost walks and a pig and oyster fest. And it's a very fascinating place.
That's great. Thank you so much, Emily. I think it is a museum that is often overlooked, the Old Coast Guard Museum, and it's very central to the rest of Virginia Beach. Now moving away from Virginia Beach toward Waverly, there is another museum worth noting, and it's the Miles B. Carpenter Museum. This man, John, has a fascinating history.
Yes, he was actually from Pennsylvania, and he moved down to Waverly as a young man and got into the lumber business. He operated a lumber yard, sawmill, and other businesses there in Waverly. And about 1940 or so, for some reason, the business started dropping off, and to pass the time, he took up whittling. And he, although he started out just making small figures, eventually he just kind of turned himself into a folk artist, kind of to whittling and sculpture as Grandma Moses was to painting. He lived in this house the whole time he lived in Waverly. He died in 1985, by the way. And the house was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1989 and now is operated as a house museum and also as his studio. Actually, he did most of his carving in his kitchen. And he used found pieces, twisted pieces of wood. It wasn't that so much that he sculpted pieces out of solid blocks of wood. He used whatever he found. He mixed media and became quite famous in his time, especially in the 1950s and 60s. Several of his pieces can be seen on permanent display up at the Smithsonian Museum, and there's one called a monkey dog that he did in 1967 that looks, from some angles, it looks like a monkey, and others it looks like a dog, and another one called Root Monster, which is actually a root that he found shaped real oddly. And the head of it looks kind of like a snake, and then he painted it, so it's got all these limbs sticking out of the snake every which way.
That's the Miles B. Carpenter Museum. That's in Waverly. We'll head on over now to Suffolk, where, Joe, there is really no question that it's the peanut capital.
Exactly. My grandfather used to hang out in Suffolk when he was an oysterman out on the James River, Robert Junius Tennis, and he would go to Suffolk and into Franklin. And Suffolk, of course, has little statues of Mr. Peanut standing all over the town. And Mr. Peanut came out of his shell wearing a chef's hat at first. In another sketch, the cartoon goober carried a lunchbox that said Planners. A Suffolk teenager created this hand-drawn character in 1916 and won $5 when Mr. Peanut became the symbol of the Planners Nut and Chocolate Company. Now, of course, Planners was established in Pennsylvania and moved its headquarters to Suffolk in 1913. The similar times we had peanut factories in operation among all of Suffolk's sprawling peanut farms. And back to Waverly, Dr. Matthew Harris harvested a crop near Waverly in the 1840s, and that's kind of what started the whole commercially grown peanuts industry.
I'm getting hungry. I want to talk about Brunswick stew, too. So what I'd like to do, Joe, is read this excerpt from your book in your words. Stew masters of Brunswick County would cook squirrel. They just can't find many. Over the past century or so, the natural squirrel population has been largely depleted, so they'll likely chop chicken instead when they stir early in the morning. It's all for the Battle of the Brunswicks. Both Brunswick County, Virginia, and Brunswick, Georgia, claim to be the birthplace of Brunswick stew. That is so fascinating. Is there a winner?
You know, there was a winner one time. The Virginians won, but the mayor of Brunswick, Georgia, ran over and stole the trophy and caused a big hullabaloo. I was later told that this was actually a staged event to try to get to have a little fun. But, you know, we have the journey that we're on going from one side of Virginia to the other. We are still wrought with a lot of battles and such. And one of which going out that has connections to both Jamestown and the center of the state is Bacon's Rebellion. And Bacon's Rebellion, every time I hear about Bacon's Rebellion, I guess I think of, you know, how Nathaniel Bacon cooked up a plan. The young lawyer had grown tired of the Susquehannock Indians who raided outposts on the Virginia frontier, and he was equally upset about rural Governor William Berkeley's failure to do much about it. So he went west with about 200 men in 1676 and approached the Okanichi Indians living at a four-mile-long island on the Roanoke River. The Okanichi had a monopoly on furs, and they had a business association with Berkeley trading animal skins. You know, he sliced apart the Okanichi village and killed an unknown number of the tribe. He then took off with the Okanichi's beaver pelts. But there's also this connection back to the colonial capital of Jamestown that hailed Bacon as a hero for fighting the Indians. And I think John has a story about Jamestown, doesn't he?
He does. John, tell us about the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail, which has ties to Jamestown.
Sure. In 1608, Smith made two voyages throughout the Chesapeake Bay, adding up to a couple thousand miles. And the purpose of his going out, he took about a dozen men with him in what they called a shallop, which was basically a big rowboat that also had a sail, was to try to find the Northwest Passage to the Pacific Ocean, which, of course, didn't exist, but they didn't know that. And also, he made contact with a lot of Indian tribes all up and down both sides of the bay, and made some trade arrangements, which didn't please the paramount chief Powhatan, who thought he could control the English strangers. But all of this started out at Jamestown, and Jamestown is just a wonderful place to visit and start exploring the bay from. Even though it's a distance away, but it's the starting point for Smith's voyages.
John, take us to toward the Piedmont, as it were. Will you tell us a little bit more about the Sailor's Creek Battlefield, which is right there just east of Farmville?
Oh, okay. Well, Sailor's Creek is located just a little bit east of Farmville. And this was a battle that was fought on April 6, 1865, during Lee's retreat from Richmond and Petersburg. He was trying to go far enough west to escape the pursuing Union Army and turn south into North Carolina and join up with General Joseph Johnston's forces there. But they caught up with him at Sailor's Creek, and there were actually three different engagements. It was a sort of spread-out battle. It is now a state park, Sailor's Creek Battlefield State Park, and there's a great visitor center there. The land itself is virtually pristine. It's just farms like it's always been, and the visitor center has great interpretation of all of this.
Great. So people can enjoy this just like they would any state park here in Virginia.
Oh, yes.
Wonderful. And, you know, while we're just stopping off on this trail, I guess it's a good time to say goodbye to you and to Emily. And quick question for you guys as you work together as a team writing stories about Virginia. Who does what? How do you break up the division of labor?
Well, we just kind of look things over and decide who maybe has more of a background in certain areas than others.
What about you, Emily? What are you doing?
Well, I like to write the captions for the pictures, and John does the broad stories that introduce each chapter.
Sounds like great teamwork going on.
We have a lot of fun doing it. We're still married after almost 35 years.
That's wonderful. And how many books after 35 years?
Ooh. We've lost count.
I don't know.
I saw the number 14 somewhere, but I don't know how updated that was.
That may be true.
Wonderful. Such a pleasure to talk with both of you, John Salmon, Emily Salmon. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Joe, you're still with us as we head out to Boyd Tavern.
Boyd Tavern is in Boydton, and it's the story of a wonderful old tavern that has some ties back to the Civil War. It was a hot spot as well for horse racing participants, all gathered winner or loser for the hotel's lavish balls. But after 1832, all bets were off. The racetrack there had become the site of Randolph-Macon College, and the tavern became a meeting place for students and professors. During the Civil War, Confederate troops mustered outside Boyd Tavern. Randolph-Macon, meanwhile, lost both students and professors to battlefields, plus most of the school's endowment to worthless Confederate bonds. Now, the Boydton campus of Randolph-Macon closed. It moved over to Ashland, Virginia, leaving kind of a little ghost town. And Boydton has been a town that has been basically noted as the town that just will not die. It's the county seat of Mecklenburg County, which is one of the most wonderful counties to discover on the south side, or Piedmont, or southern Virginia area, as it's now called.
I love this story because I'm fascinated by mineral water, the hot springs, the warm springs. And if you will, take us to Clarksville and tell us the story of the man who knew how to bottle the spring water.
You know, this is the story of Thomas F. Good. He could turn on the faucet, but he had to find it first. The old spring that the locals had loved the most at Buffalo Springs, it contained the mineral lithia. It had become overgrown in an overgrowth of brush.
How did he find this, though? Didn't he have help from some local woman?
He did. He went and started talking to an old woman, and she says, "Let me see here now. It's right here." And he found this location of this nearly forgotten fount, as we'll say. He hooked that water into his bottling plant at Mecklenburg, called it Spring Number 2, started selling this stuff all over United States, England, France, and Cuba in the 1880s. So it is now still, now today you can go, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has this area at Buffalo Springs, you can bottle it yourself for free.
Oh, that's no fun.
Well.
This doesn't sound like the American way. Now, at that time, were the other hot springs as popular? Yes.
And this was something that was going on through the 1930s. We had spring resorts all over Virginia. And in my Southwest Virginia Crossroads book, I write about Yellow Sulphur Springs, Montgomery Springs. In my latest book on Washington County, I talk about the Washington Springs Hotel. And it is also noted as another place. So spring resorts were all over Virginia, but I don't think anything was really as more famous as what we had at Warm Springs, Hot Springs, Healing Springs, all up in the Bath County area.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We're talking with author Joe Tennis, and we'll be heading west some more, back with more roads, rails, and trails of Virginia.